Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 19th of April, 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, of course, Mike Robinson. And Mike, a lovely sunny day here.
A lovely sunny day here, yes. I'm not sure what it was like in Geneva yesterday when they were giving their briefing at the OPCW. They actually announced one of the members of the technical team that came to Salisbury. That was Mr. Mark Michael Bloom, and he was giving a briefing to the member states representatives at the OPCW yesterday. And of course, his briefing is absolutely secret, Brian. We can't know what he said. There are lots of documents, lots of comments from various national representatives on the OPCW website, but yeah. What Mark Michael Bloom said, we don't know. So he was the head of the OPCW laboratory and leader of the technical assistance team that went to Salisbury. So that meeting took place, and then shortly after that, Karen Pearce, our illustrious UK permanent representative to the United Nations Security Council, was giving her thoughts about that briefing to the Security Council. Here she is, looking particularly fetching in this suit with some kind of yellow and red flowers on it.
Or butterflies, possibly butterflies.
It's hard to say. But anyway, she gave a statement. She said that the meeting was taking place immediately after the OPCW meeting. Apologies, that was the OPCW meeting was in The Hague. I'd like to say, she said, a word about the use of the term Novichok. This is a term we use to describe these chemicals. We take the Russian term for such nerve agents. The OPCW report itself does not use the term Novichok, but the point I wish to stress is that it is the chemical that we said it was, and so there shouldn't be any lack of clarity on this point. Okay? So that's very important. It is Novichok, and the OPCW report says it's Novichok, but the public isn't allowed to see the OPCW report, so we've got to take her word for it, and we've got to take her word for it that it is the chemical that they said it was.
Yes, although we know that there are several different strains of Novichok.
Indeed, we don't know which one. We don't know the chemical makeup. We don't know what it was. Okay, so she said the report sets out full forensic chain of custody. I'm sure it does. Don't know, though. Finally, the report notes the absence of any significant amount of impurities in the chemicals that were detected. High purity is the description given in the executive summary in paragraph 11. Now, the executive summary is public. It was released on the 12th, but this is the document, the 12th of April. This is the document which doesn't specify the chemical makeup of the toxin, but it does say that it's high purity. So she goes on to say, this suggests, in turn, that a highly sophisticated laboratory, i.e. a state laboratory, made the chemicals. She said a combination of credible open source reporting and intelligence shows us that in the 1980s, the Soviet Union developed a new class of fourth generation nerve agents, the code word for the offensive chemical weapons program, of which Novichoks were one part, was Foliant. By 1993, she said, when Russia signed the Chemical Weapons Convention, it's likely that some Novichoks had passed acceptance testing. She said that no terrorist group or non-state actor would be able to produce the agent in the purity described by the OPCW testing. And this is something that Russia has acknowledged. Russia has a proven record, she said, of conducting state-sponsored assassinations, including on the territory of the UK. And of course, she went on to talk about Litvinenko. During the 2000s, Russia commenced a program to test means of delivering chemical warfare agents and to train personnel from special units in the use of such weapons, she claims. And then she went on to talk about motive, and she said that Sergei Skripal, of course, was a former Russian military intelligence officer from the GRU. He was convicted of espionage in 2006. It's highly likely, she says, that the Russian intelligence services view at least some of its defectors as legitimate targets for assassination. I'd like to turn, she said, then to an update on the Skripals themselves. She said that the Russians asked us to pass on the offer to provide consular services to Yulia. Yulia herself said, she said in a statement on the 11th of April, I have access to my friends and family and so on. Well, of course, Yulia herself didn't say that in a statement. That statement was issued on her behalf by the Metropolitan Police, and we don't know what Yulia herself has said. She hasn't said it to camera. She hasn't made any public statement herself. It's all through government third parties. So Karen Pierce went on to say the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has claimed that traces of the toxic chemical BZ were found in the samples analysed by the OPCW, and this disclosed the location of one of the independent laboratories that OPCW used. The OPCW themselves have not disclosed the identity of the labs, nor have they produced any information about BZ samples in the executive summary. That's because, Ms. Pierce, they didn't provide any information about any of the chemicals in the executive summary. There was no chemical definition. There was no term used to describe the chemicals in the executive summary. So you're lying through your teeth here. It's spectacular. And she finally said the Director General has confirmed unreservedly that there was no BZ in any of the samples taken by the OPCW in Salisbury. Well, I haven't seen such a confirmation. I'd be interested in seeing that. But then she produced a right of reply, a written right of reply, which was given at this meeting, which ended up saying that the Russian account of UK behaviour and what's happening on the ground in either Salisbury or Syria is a rewrite of George Orwell's 1984, updated for the modern day and modern Russian methods. Brian, I nearly fell off my chair when I read that, because I just wonder, what is she been sniffing something?
Possibly.
Possibly.
I was smiling while you were reading that report, Mike, because somebody in the chat box beat me to it. We're told that this is now high purity Novichok, so a military grade nerve agent of very high purity. But apparently, after you've had a little dose of it, you go for a beer, then you go for a meal, as you do. And after that, you start to feel a bit poorly. But we know it's not a problem, because Public Health England said if you get any problems with this military grade Novichok, make sure that you wash your clothes. And if the clothes can't be washed with soap or detergent and water, then you send them off to the dry cleaners, but put them in two bags. So this is so bizarre, Mike, it's almost impossible to report, because the official UK government report cannot possibly be true. It cannot be true that this was high purity military grade nerve agent, and after you've had a dose you go and have a beer and lunch. It was designed to kill people. It was designed to kill people in minutes, and any former military people who've done the training, particularly during the Cold War period where that sort of training was very intense, know that you were told in no uncertain terms this stuff touches you, you breathe it in, you inhale it because somebody next to you has been sick, you are going to die. And now all of a sudden we've got all you need to do is wash your clothes. This is utter pantomime by the British state. And Mike, you've said that the lady can't possibly be telling the truth. I also agree the British government is utterly lying over its account of what's taken place in Salisbury. I don't know how much stronger we can put it.
No, so pretty unsurprisingly, the Russians have come out against this. This is Alexander Shulgin, who's the Russians representative to the OPCW. And he had eight questions, or at least eight points that he wanted to make. The first was that the allegation that Russia refuses to answer UK's questions, which of course is nonsense. He wanted to make the point that the UK, any suggestion that the UK abides by the chemical or has abided by the Chemical Weapons Convention rulebook in this case is nonsense. The suggestion that Russia has refused to cooperate, which the British have made on numerous occasions, of course, is nonsense. And in fact, the Russians, if you remember, said, we want to have a joint investigation. Please, can we have a joint investigation? And Britain said, absolutely not. By the way, Russia's refusing to cooperate. It's staggering. He was commenting on the allegations that Russia is inventing versions of the story to distract attention. And as you can see on screen, this is what he said. Russia has been accused of inventing 30 versions of the Salisbury events to disrupt the investigations. In reality, the picture is different. In fact, it's the British tabloids which are multiplying those versions. Well,
that's correct.
Well, I don't think it is absolutely correct, because it's also the government pushing information out to the newspapers, because as their narrative collapses when people ask questions, they're having to try to chase the lie, which, of course, we all know doesn't work.
It doesn't work. I can also say that we know that at least some of the mainstream papers were too frightened to actually report alternative opinions on what actually has taken place in Salisbury. And even though a number of former military people came forward to say that the British government account cannot be true if the substance is a military grade nerve agent, the papers, whoa, we can't go there. So we're now looking at mainstream media in Britain absolutely terrified of our own government. So all they print, and I take your correction, Mike, the government pushes out the information, and then the papers and the media and the BBC simply spew this out. And it doesn't matter whether it changes on a day-by-day basis or it's contradictory, they continue to push it out. Mm. So, yeah.
Now, the head of the OPCW made a second statement yesterday regarding the investigation in Syria and Douma, and he made the point that the inspectors had attempted to get to the site, to two separate sites in Douma yesterday, that the first group of inspectors ended up with a large crowd of people around them, and so they were advised to remove themselves from the situation, and in the second location they were shot at with small arms fire. This is exactly what the Russians and the Syrians were saying, that there are security issues still there, and that this was why the OPCW staff had not as yet been allowed access to the site. But of course, the British government was spinning that as being Russia and Syria getting in the way of the investigation. Yeah. So the head of the OPCW made that clear yesterday. They're going to have another go apparently today. But in the meantime, with regard to Syria, I wanted to highlight a couple of articles here. The first one is from Paul Mason in New Statesman. And the headline is, "Unless the West respects international law, it has no hope of preventing a new era of militarism." He says, "All strategies to cope with global chaos have to be based around repairing the United Nations, not abandoning it." He talks about Leonard Wolf, who helped design the UN in the first place, collected articles published in the book International Government in 1916, laid the legal and moral foundations for the League of Nations and ultimately for the UN. And Mason says, if you're going to empower a supranational body to act as the world's policeman, its actions should take place only on the basis of international law. Anything less, said Wolf, and you're simply replicating the problems of militarism and imperialism. In the face of this new international disorder, both the right and left wings of the British Labour movement are clutching at political principles that no longer help. And he goes on to say, either the UN is dead as a supranational legal entity, in which case you move to Plan B, which I'll outline below. I'm not going to talk about that today, or it's savable. At the moment, it's wise to act as if it were savable, even as Sergei Lavrov and Nikki Haley throw bile at each other across the table. And he finishes off by saying, Russia has a veto over actions Britain can take in the enforcement of international law because we signed the UN Charter. It has no veto over our relationship with Ireland. And he makes the point, although Brussels does. So he's making some good points. But ultimately, Brian, at the end of the day, the point he's missing is it's in the headline. Unless the West respects international law, it has no hope of preventing a new era of militarism. He is assuming that the West wants to prevent a new era of militarism. And that's the issue that I have with the position he's taking. He makes some good points in the article. But if you come from that premise, you can never get to the right answer.
Yeah, and many of these journalists never get near the right answer because they just simply don't stay on the case, following the evidence and asking the right trail. And I've already said that we know that mainstream papers have been warned off reporting alternative opinions.
And let's look at another one from a similar type, I suppose. This is in Spectator USA. Has Britain already forgotten the Chilcot report? And this is from Peter Oborne. And he's saying almost 2 years have passed since Sir John Chilcot produced his 12-volume report on the lessons of the Iraq War. We collectively promised to learn the lessons. Last weekend, it was as if the Chilcot report never happened. Britain, cheered on by a bellicose press and a largely docile parliament, launched airstrikes that showed the same disregard for due process which Chilcot warned about. It's deja vu over again. Britain, France, the United States ignoring the United Nations, international law and due process. Britain justified her actions by claiming that Russia vetoed UN Security Council resolutions for chemical inspectors to investigate what happens. These claims are disingenuous. There are big questions here. Courtesy of Chilcot, we all know that British and American intelligence were deeply complicit in the falsehoods told about weapons of mass destruction to justify Iraq. This makes it all the more significant that we pay attention to the respectable voices. That's his mistake, by the way. Pay attention to the respectable voices who are questioning the government's narrative of events. Former Sea Lord Admiral West, former SAS Commander Jonathan Shaw, former British Ambassador Peter Ford have all made interesting contributions to the debate. And then he goes on to talk about Robert Fisk and defend Robert Fisk. And he concludes by saying, so let's not jump to conclusions. Let's listen to those who challenge our assumptions. We have a profound moral duty to doubt the official version of events. The next attack could take us into a regional conflagration, which was only narrowly avoided last weekend. So let's pay attention to the advice proffered by boring old Sir John Chilcot. And while I agree again with much of what O'Bourne is saying here, once again he says, let's listen to those who challenge our assumptions. And yet he is the man, one of the key people who criticises Vanessa Bailey, for example. He is constantly criticising her and throwing bile at her, in fact, yeah, to use the term. Again, here's another one that needs to rethink their position, I think. Just on this, again, on the same issue, apparently Avaz now actively campaigning against RT. So we've now got the government attack on RT through Ofcom that we talked about yesterday. And we've now got the NGO Soros link through Avaz. But apparently any narrative which, as O'Bourne says, is important to listen to, we need to shut down as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
I wanted to remind people about this. We did mention it at the time. This was Demos. Their concern about experts not being recognised or not being respected by the public. Now, they launched this little exercise in November last year. It's called The Evolution of Expertise, and it's about to report. So hopefully we'll have more on this in a day or two, but I just wanted to prime everybody for it. This project, they said, will investigate the causes and manifestations of declining trust in expertise in the digital age and whether new models of trust could help to alleviate the situation or take its place. Using digital research from our pioneering Centre for the Analysis of Social Media, Demos will capture the views of thousands of British citizens to identify what drives trust and mistrust online. How that changes by age, education and other demographic information will then test the findings on social media to see how they reflect the spread of information through media networks online. The project will provide an empirical understanding of how and why the landscape of trust is changing and produce new ideas of how both new and conventional institutions could react to these changes. Brian, this is this entire premise here that expertise is not recognised, that expertise is not trusted. It ignores the fundamental basic problem that the reason that expertise isn't recognised or trusted is because the experts that are trotted out by the mainstream media increasingly are lying through their teeth.
Well, this is answered in a nutshell. All their people who are not capable of producing the right quality information. And this is one of the things we'll move on to in just a moment. But we look at the BBC and you say who is producing the material and we don't know. So we don't even know the qualifications of the people.
Yes.
Wasn't Demos going to go into schools and help teach children about real news?
Oh, they are doing that, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, in parallel. OK, reminder, Media on Trial. Details, mediaontrial.uk in Leeds, 27th of May, 2018. Tickets are available at that website. Get along if you possibly can. It is needed.
Okay, well, let's have a look at the BBC, because, of course, the BBC has finally jumped on the bandwagon of attacking people reporting an alternative view on Syria. Vanessa Bealey features very strongly in this, but it's BBC Trending that's taken the lead position. And the first thing I've discovered when you try and go to look and see what exactly BBC Trending is it's not always clear, because we've got here the BBC World Service with Trending, but this doesn't appear to be the Trending itself. Whether it's just accidental or it's supposed to be confusing deliberately, I don't know. This is the Trending genuine Twitter page. And my goodness, if you look at the tweets on it, and I'd encourage people to go and look at the tweets on it, it's probably like, I'm going to say, some 17-year-old youth has put on, because there's no substance. It's all supposition and images and rhetoric, branding anybody they can as alternative right. And some of it is done in quite an extreme way. So we've got a nice Ku Klux Klan type image there right at the top. But we are to believe the information on this BBC site without really any backup as to why. Now, if you go on to it, you can see that the gentleman, Mike Wending, that we mentioned yesterday, we're coming on to him and his relationship with Vanessa Bealey. So here he's busy attacking anybody who's commented on Sandy Hook. He's made a number of attacks on Alex Jones, but it's thrown in there. There's no substance. There's no backing to it. This is just a tweeted story or part of it, a snapshot. But we are to believe that this is expert opinion, Mike. No wonder people don't believe it. If you go there, there's the link through to the actual website itself. If you click that, you're taken to this BBC Trending story. And here we're getting into the attack on anybody who is reporting what's really happening in Syria. So Syria war, the online activists pushing conspiracy theories. And there's a big attack in this on Vanessa Bealey. And they've used one of her tweets, which looks pretty fair to me. She says US and UK are running a psychological warfare campaign supported by their fawning media, including the BBC, CNN, Guardian, Channel 4, to subject Syrian people to further trauma after 7 years of punishing terrorist war waged by the US and UK alliance against innocent civilians. I have to say that sounds pretty straightforward to me. And I don't disagree with it. But this is where the spin comes in, because if you look to see who in the BBC has written this article, it's anonymous.
There's no byline.
There's nothing there. We are apparently to believe that simply because it's come out of the BBC, we can trust this story. We spoke to the BBC media team this morning to ask them who had produced this article. They said, could we send an email? We sent an email. And true to form, we haven't got any response from the BBC. I did suggest to the very nice lady who took my phone call that it was a bit disingenuous that the BBC attacks journalists who've been on the ground in Syria, but the BBC journalists are not named. Now, we had reason to believe that Mike Wending was the man who was involved with this, because he had emailed Vanessa Bealey. Mike read out some of his questions. It was an interrogation. So possibly this man is the lead author, but we don't know, because the BBC has a no-name policy similar to the Times of London.
So it seems.
Okay, so what did they have to say in the story? Well, I've just pulled out this section here. But in response to a list of questions, Vanessa Bealey called BBC Trending story a blatant attempt to silence independent journalism and repeated unsubstantiated claims about alleged chemical weapons attacks. Repeated unsubstantiated claims about alleged chemical attacks. This all gets pretty woolly.
Could that be translated to repeated unsubstantiated claims about unsubstantiated chemical weapons
attacks?
Well,
this is where I really wanted to go, because if we take another BBC headline here, Syria airstrikes, US and allies attack chemical weapons sites. So chemical weapons sites on the headline is as a fact. But when you get into the text, the US, UK and France have bombed three government sites in Syria in an early morning operation targeting chemical weapons facilities, they say. The move is a response to a suspected chemical attack on the town of Douma last week. So we've got unsubstantiated, alleged and suspected.
Yeah.
But if you comment on that, you are making repeated unsubstantiated claims about an attack which is a supposition to start off with.
Yes.
Apparently. OK, so here's the man. We thought we'd just have a look at Mr. Wendling. We are assuming he's the author. We don't know because the BBC doesn't want to tell us. If you go to his Twitter page, one of the first emails that caught my eye was somebody complaining that he's been harassing them. I have no interest in being interviewed by the BBC. With that said, I'd appreciate if you'd stop bothering me, stop messaging my friends about me as well. If you don't halt the harassment, legal measures will be taken. But what does Mike Wendling do? He's snickering at it because he's saying, well, reporters ask questions. Mm. But somebody's obviously been pretty upset here at the actions of this man. So let's have a look at this one here. Somebody left an unopened bottle of water on a table in a restaurant. And he says that basically, let me just read this. A bottle of mineral water left undrunk in a cafe in northwest London is the best thing I can think of to explain today's political climate. I mean, what is this? Is this what's in the man's head? Is this man capable of commenting on Syria and what people report?
Yeah,
I don't know. Well, what about this one? This is awesome. I wish I could say it's nothing to do with politics, but tough luck. Spend Halloween night exploring the ghost malls of northeastern Ohio on abandoned. So is this what he spends his evening doing, looking at sort of Halloween ghosty? I don't know. We've got this one. This is pretty good. So he's retweeted here. This is BBC trending. Mr. Wendling himself about fighting fake news. Success is measured by the absence of someone with a gun storming into a pizza parlor because he believes there are children imprisoned in the basement. OK, now I was fascinated that he's also got this one up and he's saying in stressful times, there's always pizza and beer and the Cleveland Browns, but mostly pizza and beer. What's in this man's head, Mike? I honestly don't know. Well, we push BBC news stories. He puts up Grenfell Tower, but the BBC's done no proper investigation into Grenfell and what actually took place. And if you talk to the residents, of course, they've never seen the BBC talking to them about what really happened. And then this one, I find this particularly offensive. Why is the alternative right obsessed with paedophilia? But at the same time, he's been promoting the BBC, putting a paedophile behind bars. But what is the message here? That if you try and expose child abuse and people doing it, you're actually alternative right.
Yeah.
He's actually undermining child abuse victims by claiming that it's all just right-wing propaganda.
Well, this is the organisation that hosted Jimmy Savile.
It is. So we wait at the moment to see whether the BBC is going to give a name for that article or whether we are now in the state where if the BBC says so, it's fact. You don't need to know who put the information together.
Well, the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting is continuing. And today the big subject has been child sexual exploitation. So here's Amber Rudd. She has announced nearly £2.6 million of funding towards tackling child sexual exploitation in the UK. That's fantastic, isn't it? So this is opening the More Secure Future event today. What day is this? Thursday. Yesterday this was. Yesterday she set out plans to provide funding to a number of projects aimed at preventing and supporting victims of child sexual exploitation. So another £600,000 will be awarded to voluntary organisations which are designed to help victims and survivors of child sexual abuse in the UK. And the African Union is going to be awarded 1.4 million, sorry, 1.4 million, to strengthen regional and national capacity within countries across Africa, including Kenya, Ghana and Nigeria. So in the UK, as I say, £600,000 from the government, dedicated £7 million victim support fund will be divided between Safeline, NAPAC and NSPCC. And then in parallel with that, Penny Mordaunt has announced that the Department for International Development will also be getting involved in this with a new aid package of support to help eradicate human trafficking and child exploitation in the Commonwealth. And more countries are committing apparently to taking action to help victims. So this is fantastic. This is a total package of £5.5 million delivered by the Home Office and DFID.
So according to the BBC, this is all extreme right wing.
Well, I guess so. £3 million to support Commonwealth governments, as we've said. £2 million to strengthen law enforcement. £500,000 to support new legislation. So this is fantastic, Penny Mordaunt. As you see, it said there, the UK and Commonwealth are stepping up to fight one of the greatest injustices of our time, the trafficking and exploitation of vulnerable people by predators. Now, it's not really clear how much of this money overlaps, but it looks like a package of £5 million or so. And I just want to remind everybody what the economic reality of trafficking and sexual exploitation is. Because the profit that is made from sexual exploitation in the UK is just shy of £900 million a year.
Billion, yeah.
No, £900 million a year is in the UK for sexual exploitation. That's one part of the overall human trafficking picture, which of course is around £2 billion in total, right? So this is the profit, and this is the government funding on the right to prevent that profit being made. And clearly that's going to be effective, isn't it? So let's look at the situation with regard to child sexual exploitation. And if we look at the number of modern slavery referrals and look at the proportion of those modern slavery referrals that are to do with children, and we can see in the sexual exploitation column that what is that, about 90% or so are child related. So this is a pathetic response announced in the name of the Commonwealth, because of course, as we've said before, the business model here is very similar to the business model of drug trafficking and so on. Any trafficking, they put a small amount of money into so-called prevention. This gives them some kind of plausible deniability while they quite happily permit this activity to continue. I don't know who benefits, but certainly the government seems to have a policy of permitting this to go.
Well, we were fascinated when we discovered that the government takes into account the sex industry in its GDP figures. So we could ask how the government has such an accurate handle on what's actually going on under the surface. And could it just be that the government knows full well what's going on because it's making profit from those activities?
Absolutely. And it gets better because Britain is a champion of democracy and human rights across the world, says Boris Johnson. So he has committed £4 million to democracy in the Commonwealth. This is going to strengthen democracy and broaden political participation across 18 Commonwealth countries. It's going to be managed by the Foreign Commonwealth Office through a consortium led by the Westminster Foundation for Democracy, partnering with the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association's UK branch, and the Commonwealth Local Government Forum. And it's going to support work with democracy institutions such as national parliaments, local authorities, and help improve transparency and foster more stable democratic societies. I'm just so excited about it. The programme is going to focus on how institutions are accountable and inclusive of all their citizens and on driving efforts to widen participation by women, minorities and other underrepresented groups. So in other words, this is pushing out the gender agenda and LGBT rights right across the Commonwealth.
Yeah. Somebody said in the chat box that the Commonwealth is literally being pushed down our throats. Well, of course, it would be, because it is the stepping stone to the full global government. The European Union system has clearly not worked out. So now we see the British deep state shifting attention to the Commonwealth, because that gives a huge number of people to act out the next step, which is one system of government.
Well, absolutely. And I'll just remind everybody that yesterday we pointed out that one of the things they seem to be doing is trying to build a single market customs union type arrangement, very much in the model of the European Union, it seems, across the Commonwealth. That is an interesting development.
Yeah.
We'll keep you posted on that. Quick update on AV9, Friday the 4th to the 7th of May. As we said, rooms, residential tickets no longer available, but day tickets are available. You can get more details on alternativeview.co.uk.
Right, OK. Let's just recap on this that we covered yesterday. We were talking basically about companies hoovering up people's private data, building a model of their personality so that they could be influenced. This was a report that UK Column made back in 2014 when we were warning that there'd been a memorandum of understanding on digital government set up between the UK and Israel. This was quite widely reported in a number of papers and media sources. Francis Maud from the Cabinet Office was at the heart of it. But what was astonishing was the amount of government structures simply being linked and put in collaboration with Israel. So we had universities, we had the police, but we also had links through to GCHQ and an organisation called the Israeli Defence Force Unit 8200. Now, what we showed yesterday was that there was a report in the paper that a company called Verint was using information which had come from another company, Terigence, which itself had been formed by that Israeli unit, and they had taken data from a minimum of 87 million people. So if I put in the missing link, we find that Unit 8200, Israeli military intelligence, the same organisation that appeared in papers that Francis Maud said that the UK was going to be sharing intimate data with, we can now see that those Israeli operations are hoovering up people's personal data, and they were feeding it, ultimately it was being fed through to Cambridge Analytica, which is another company which boasts of the ability to use personal data to change people's views and values and behaviour. We said, when did the British public ever agree to all this? But what I just wanted to emphasise today is that this unit, this Israeli unit, is so secretive that we understand that GCHQ limits all references to it except to a select few inside the organisation. So this is not a question that this is working as a possible partner in much the same way as the Americans might do. We've got an Israeli military intelligence cell which is now not to be discussed. Our question is why, and perhaps that's a key question for your MP, what this organisation is doing and why its techniques are now being used to steal people's personal data, as the Daily Mail, just one report, revealed yesterday.
Now, speaking of big data, Big Brother Watch concerned about the way that big data is being used in policing. They say the recent revelations about the improper use of big data have brought into clear focus the extent to which personal data can be aggregated and used to manipulate individuals through severe abuses of privacy. Big Brother Watch has been investigating the use of controversial big data in policing. Our investigation into the use of commercial consumer behaviour data in the public sector has resulted in the discovery of a very concerning case of police profiling data informing AI custody decisions. So this is artificial intelligence custody decisions. At the moment, the police's use of automated decision making is advisory. However, the new data protection bill, they say, currently going through Parliament, opens the door to purely automated decisions being made with significant effects on people's rights in policing and across the public and private sectors. We're calling on Parliament to urgently amend the bill to ensure that in a world of advancing AI, human rights are always protected by human decisions. So they're talking about Durham Police. They've developed a machine learning algorithm called the Harm Assessment Risk Tool, HART, to evaluate and the risk of offending. The algorithm scores offenders to place them in one of three categories, low, moderate, or high risk. with those deemed to be at moderate risk of reoffending being offered the chance to go into a rehabilitation program called Checkpoint as an alternative to prosecution. The AI tool, they say, uses 34 data categories, including the offender's criminal history, combined with their age, gender, two types of residential postcode. The use of postcode data is problematic in predictive software of this kind, as it carries the risk of perpetuating bias towards areas marked by community deprivation. This danger was identified in a draft article entitled Algorithmic Risk Assessment Policing Models, Lessons from the Durham Heart Model and Experimental Proportionality. Then they highlight something called Mosaic, which was developed by Robert Weber, working in the 1970s, in ways of better understanding patterns of urban deprivation, who eventually decided to leave academia and pursue his research in marketing, managing and micro-marketing divisions. He developed Acorn, the first geo-demographic classification system in the UK, and later Experian, where he developed Mosaic, which was released in 1986. So this is all about Experian and Experian's data being used by the police to predict the potential for crime. So while Experian holds that all data they gather is privacy compliant, there are serious questions, they say, to be asked about the issue of whether the aggregation of such enormous quantities of personal data is ethical and truly respects the right of privacy. It's clear that Heart is still in an experimental phase. The program has not been running long enough to assess whether the predicted low, moderate, high-risk suspects will prove to be so. Nevertheless, it does not make the issue any less urgent or serious. Durham's Harm Assessment Risk Tool is the first predictive policing tool to be used in decision-making about individuals and therefore extremely significant in the precedent it sets. I couldn't agree more, and I think we should be looking a lot closer at how police are using data and asking them a lot more questions.
And people can't simply sit and watch this lot close in. It requires people to stand up and be counted and to challenge this system and to get in front of those MPs and essentially rub their noses in it so they understand, because a lot of them don't. The arrogance and the ignorance amongst members of parliament, truly astonishing. They're going to be caught up in this net the same as other people. Well, are the police going to help us? Apparently not. You'll be glad to know, Mike, that today is World Police Twitterthon Day. This is real. It is quite unbelievable. It's tomorrow. I beg your pardon. I got carried away there. Friday, the 27th of April, is Police Tweetathon Day. Share with the world what you do. Just include hashtag PollTwit. I can't even bother to read it. This is incredible reframing. We have supposed professionals, and we know that in Britain at the moment, the police can't keep up with murders in London. They can't keep up with white collar crime, fraud, etc. They can't do things on the streets. They haven't got enough people to police. And yet their brains are now so scrambled with brainwashing that they are acting as a body of people on a world tweet-a-thon.
Excellent. So they're going to spend a whole day with their phones out tweeting instead of catching criminals. Yep. That's good use of police time.
Good use of police time. And if you're unhappy about it, then get on to your local constabulary and ask them what they're doing. Of course, we've got, can't remember his name, the policeman here in Devon and Cornwall Constabulary, who thinks he's one of the world's best tweeters. Twit. Right. Well, BBC, we have to come back to the BBC, because it took the Daily Mail to reveal that BBC proms are to feature disco punk and pagan gospel this year to try and attract a younger audience.
Sorry, what's that got to do with classical music?
It hasn't got anything to do with it at all, but this is the BBC after the minds of youth, pagan gospel. And if you want to know what that's about, I'm going to say, if you go to look at the videos, then take a bit of caution. Here's the man. So it's spiritual musician Josiah Wise. He calls himself Serpent with Feet. And this is the BBC role model for young people. I think you should go and have a look at some of his video clips online to see what sort of environments he does his thing in, and sometimes it's difficult to tell whether it's him or a her. But the BBC thinks this is ideal role model for young people, and this is the man who clearly is leading this, the BBC Proms director, David Pickard.
Yeah.
Okay, well, quick advert for the NHS conference on the 12th of May. Thank you very much for the people who've bought tickets over the last few days. We would like to see that hall filled because our health and looking after our health is so important. And it's quite clear to us that without public support, the government is going to destroy the NHS. And of course, that affects all sorts of wider healthcare. So if you haven't got a ticket, do that. And on the subject of health, I'd like to point you at this excellent article, which is by Christina England. It's just come in to us today. So Merck accused of fraud, deceit and negligence in US Gardasil case. And if I bring some of this up on the screen, what has she got to say in this? Well, the start of it is a case in July 2016. A case was filed in the Superior Court of the State of California. The case involved a 16-year-old female who between 2010 and 2011 received three injections of Gardasil, the HPV vaccination manufactured by Merck. Shortly after she received her third vaccination, she suffered a severe adverse reaction, the nature and complexity of which failed to be diagnosed in 2015 when she finally received the diagnosis of postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. And I think what that essentially is, you've got nerve ending damage and it makes it difficult for you to stay vertical. I hope I've got that simplistic explanation right. But she has suffered unbelievably. And look at this. There's been documented evidence that the HPV vaccine has caused more injuries than any other vaccination in history. Despite this evidence, however, the HPV vaccination has continued to be hailed as a success by the pharmaceutical industry and governments alike. According to WHO, the World Health Organization, Vigi Access Database, as of April the 9th, 2018, a total of 85,329 reports of adverse reactions have been filed regarding HPV vaccination. These reports include 37,699 reports of nervous system disorders, 2,458 cardiac disorders, including 38 cardiac arrests, 533 reports of POTS, and over 3,200 reports of seizures or epilepsy, and on it goes. This is truly horrific stuff, and we're going to say well done to Christina England for producing this excellent report. Do go and have a look at the article there at Green Med Info, and on the right is VAC Truth, which is Christina's site. And we'll end on this one. This really takes the biscuit. CNBC. Goldman Sachs asks, in biotech research report, is curing patients a sustainable business model?
Good.
Okay. You're probably thinking this can't be right, but it is. So they cited that in Gilead Sciences treatments for hepatitis C, which achieved cure rates of more than 90%, the company's US sales peaked at $12.5 billion in 2015, but have been falling ever since. Goldman estimates that US sales for these treatments will be less than $4 billion this year, according to a table in the report. And we'll give you the last bit. So Gilead is a case in point where the success of its hepatitis C franchise has gradually exhausted the available pool of treatable patients, the analyst wrote. In the case of infectious diseases such as hepatitis C, curing existing patients also decreases the number of carriers able to transmit the virus to new patients. This is really bad. Thus, the incident pool also declines. Where an incident pool remains stable in cancer, for example, the potential for a cure poses less risk to the sustainability of a franchise. If anybody ever wanted evidence that Big Pharma was simply about profit,
yeah,
we're going to thank them. Well done, Goldman Sachs, for spelling that out so clearly.
Yeah.
And with a minute to go, we'll lighten things a little bit. We're going to say vive la France because apparently they had to turn to Plan B when their missiles failed to launch in the strike on Syria. This was a warship. A multi-mission frigate failed to fire its salvo of three naval cruise missiles during last weekend's joint airstrike. But not to worry, because they had a backup ship.
Right.
So what was clearly a disaster has been rewritten. I think this is utterly brilliant by Army Colonel Patrick Steiger, spokesman for the French Joint Chief of Staff. It was a cock-up, but it's been turned around. We always had this cunning plan that we'd have another ship ready.
Yeah, is this like firing fireworks, that once you hit the launch button, you don't want to be looking down the tube?
Well, if people care to go onto YouTube and put missile launch failures, they will see all sorts of failures of the military across the world where the rocket does not go quite as planned. So we do feel sympathetic for the French on this occasion that their rockets did not take off. We'll leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us, and a big thank you to all the people who attended the George meeting in Plymouth last night, including those who came all the way from Ireland. Nice to see you. That's it for today. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.